Our next guest on the program writes about baseball for Sports Illustrated and SI.com, and he's the author of a brand new book that will come out soon entitled The Cooperstown Casebook. Jay Jaffe, great to have you back on the show with us.
Hey, always a pleasure, Rich. Good to be back.
I was reading the intro to your book, which is, you know, all us eager fans can get our hands on at this point, but you begin with a very interesting question. The Hall of Fame has certainly taken some hits in recent years, and it's hard to get a read on the thinking sometimes of the committee. So why should we care about the Baseball Hall of Fame?
Well, you know, I think it comes down to preserving the history of the sport and winning over new generations of fans. Those of us who are old enough to have experienced the primes of Hank Aaron and Willie Mays and players like that are dwindling in number. I don't even count myself among that group. And when you look back, the Hall of Fame has really been underrepresented in terms of players from the era that came after that. I mean, you can go as far back to 1969, where the level of players elected per team has dropped significantly, and as fewer fans with firsthand experience of these golden age greats are around, I think we need new reasons to draw people to Cooperstown. And for as imperfect as, say, the past era has been with the Barry Bonds and the steroid era folks and some of the other players who had questions about the performance, those are the players that a whole generation looks to and I think still need to be considered. As well as players from the 70s, such as Ted Simmons and Bobby Gritch, Alan Trammell, Lou Whitaker, a whole bunch of guys who've been bypassed, who were believed by the voters at the time, mistakenly, not to be good enough for the Hall. We need to get those guys in and keep some continuity for fans to go back to see their favorites.
Is that a question of the age of the average Baseball Writers Association of America voter?
Well, somewhat yes, but I mean, even now, I mean, the electorate is getting younger. They just, over the last couple of years, just started sunsetting members who are more than 10 years removed from active coverage. The ones who covered the Hank Aarons and the Willie Mayses, they're gone now. They're either in their golden years or they're gone completely. So I think it's more a matter of getting past those who really themselves can't get past what happened in the steroid era. And I understand why some of those writers, feel like they were lied to by these guys about PEDs and things like that. But what's happened is there's been this split in the electorate, and it's clogged up the ballot, and it's made it harder for down ballot candidates like Larry Walker and Edgar Martinez and Mike Messina to get the attention that they deserve, at least until very recently.
Was it easier in earlier times because there were some sort of benchmark statistical levels that people usually had to get to be considered automatics?
Sure. I mean, 500 home runs used to be automatic. Now I think it's we've added about a dozen guys with 500 homers in the last decade and a half, and we've only got 15 of the 27 in the Hall of Fame. There are a lot of guys, like I said, connected to performance-enhancing drugs, but there are some, for whom the benchmark just doesn't really resonate in the same way anymore, to the writers. And I think there's a risk in looking at those milestones and thinking they don't mean anything. I think they do, but I think they have to be appreciated in context. Likewise, I don't think we're ever going to see a 300-win pitcher again, or at least not anytime soon, so we can't use that as the benchmark for starting pitchers. And I think that we're better served by looking at advanced statistics to tell us what we can find out about defense and base running and these other previously hidden parts of the game.
Well, and speaking of that, you have revolutionized the way we look at candidates for the Hall of Fame through the JAWS system. For the uninitiated, can you give us a sort of brief summary of how JAWS works for those who don't know?
Yeah. JAWS uses wins above replacement, which is an attempt to estimate the value of a player's offense, defense, and base running. I compare players in those areas, both on a career basis and on a peak basis, which I define as a player's best 7 years, to the players who are already in the Hall of Fame at their position. What wins above replacement does is it kind of levels the playing field in terms of being able to compare high-scoring eras to low-scoring eras, players who hit in favorable ballparks and ones who hit in tough ballparks, things like that. So it's easier to compare Sandy Koufax and Pedro Martinez than it would be just by eyeballing their numbers. You know, maybe it removes a little bit of the fun of the debate, but I think it opens up far more interesting territories for debates as well.
And just to tease what we have maybe heard about the book, is it possible that in that analysis, Sandy Koufax comes up a little short?
Yeah, Sandy Koufax is, you know, was pitching in the most favorable pitching environment of, you know, in modern baseball history. He does not score particularly well by my system, but let's remember he had a very short major league career, only 12 seasons. What Jaws does not do, and what I believe still is cogent when it comes to a Hall of Fame argument, is postseason play. He was brilliant there. I don't think that should be overlooked. I think, you know, when you want to whittle it down to, you know, what do we know about this player? What can we quantify about this player? And then what's the other stuff that we can more subjectively value? I think it's easier when you address the two things separately like that. The arguments become a little bit more clear, at least in my mind.
Some of the early guys, it's hard to know what the criteria were. A guy like Rabbit Moranvillo, I think, hit 257 for his career. But in the modern era, is there someone else that, at least statistically, doesn't quite measure up?
Yeah, you know, we've got a coming candidate who I think is going to be a big flashpoint for debate, a shortstop, Omar Vizquel. Very flashy fielder, often cited as the second coming of Ozzie Smith. But while, you know, he certainly filled the highlight reels and was on, you know, the Web Gems and the Baseball Tonight highlight shows and things like that, his overall defensive numbers aren't in the same class as Ozzie's. And despite playing in a better hitter's era, his offensive numbers aren't nearly as good as well. So when you add it up, he comes up significantly short by my system, and it'll be very interesting to see. I think he's going to be a big, a big point of argument between the traditionalists and the stat heads.
If we excuse those guys, who are ineligible, like Pete Rose, or those who perhaps are tainted by the steroid era, who is an example of a gross oversight? Someone that ought to be in, but people just didn't understand what they did.
Minnie Minoso comes to mind. Hugely important pioneer for Latin American ball players. You know, I think the gimmickry of his late career, where he came back and had some pinch hitting appearances for the White Sox in his 50s, I think distorted the memory of him. But, you know, for 11 years, he was, one of the best ball players in the American League. And he just hasn't gotten the time of day. I think Bobby Gritsch from the 70s Orioles and Angels teams into the 80s, a very strong player, one of the top 10 second basemen of all time. Lou Whitaker and his double play partner, Alan Trammell, both drastically overlooked. Trammell spent 15 years on the ballot, and only in his final year did he get even half the support necessary to get in. Whitaker went one and done on the ballot, didn't even get 5% in his lone year, which made him ineligible for future consideration by the writers. And he's never gotten another look from the veterans committees. Ted Simmons kind of in that class as well. More recently, Larry Walker is one that I think is criminally overlooked. Fantastic hitter, even when you adjust for the time that he played in Colorado, the very favorable hitting environment there, he compares favorably to the right fielders in the Hall of Fame.
I've always been somebody who's in favor of an inclusive hall. I like to see as many people in there as possible. It's been so subjective in choosing people through the years. Should it be a science, should it be an art, or should it be some sort of a combination of the two?
Well, you know, I think there's room for a combination of the two, but, you know, in my mind, what's happened, what we spent so long dealing with was that it was just a popularity contest. And at some point, you know, I think it's important that merit triumph over fame here, even though it is the Hall of Fame and not the quote-unquote Hall of Merit. You know, I think we want to recognize the best, and we want to use the tools that we have to recognize the best. And the tools that we have, you know, it's not just about paying lip service to base running and defense anymore. We have the tools to measure that stuff. We should be aiming to recognize the best, you know, even if we didn't always see their skills as number one or as the best in their own time.
You can pre-order the Cooperstown Casebook right now on Amazon.com. The official release date next week, next Tuesday, the 25th. The Cooperstown Casebook, Jay Jaffe, can't wait to read it. And thanks so much for getting us into your busy schedule here.
All right, sure thing, Rich. Thank you.